This is The Guardian. I'm Regid Ahmed, coming to you from Gadigal land. The fallout since the arrest of former Prince Andrew only seems to be gathering pace as British MPs now vote to release documents relating to his time as trade envoy. Andrew was arrested on suspicion of misconduct in public office relating to that role. He's previously denied wrongdoing over his links to Jeffrey Epstein. Today, we're bringing you an episode from The Guardian's international news podcast Today in Focus on whether the monarchy can survive the scandal of Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor. Here's host Helen Pidd.
It's a week now since the man formerly known as Prince Andrew was arrested at Sandringham on the morning of his 66th birthday.
The former Prince Andrew has tonight been released under investigation from a police station in Norfolk, where he has spent the day in custody following his arrest this morning.
While police continue to investigate whether he committed misconduct in a public office, MPs voted on Tuesday to release files relating to his appointment as a UK trade envoy at the start of the millennium. They did not pull their punches.
A man on a constant self-aggrandizing and self-enriching hustle. A rude, arrogant and entitled man who could not distinguish between the public interest, which he said he served, and his own private interest.
Meanwhile, the royal family are trying to keep busy. The king went to London Fashion Week.
Good afternoon, Your Majesty.
Do you have any reactions to the arrest of your brother, sir?
Your Majesty, how are you feeling after your brother's arrest?
And the future king went to the BAFTAs. On the red carpet, conversation turned to Hamlet, the tearjerker about Shakespeare's only son. William said he couldn't face it. You need to be in quite a calm state to watch it, he said. And he wasn't at the moment. It was a tiny window into the pressure Prince William is feeling, thanks to his wayward uncle. But can the royals really be so shocked at all the allegations being levelled at Andrew, when they, and the late Queen, seem to have missed so many opportunities to nip his behaviour in the bud? One man who knows more than most about these missed opportunities is Andrew's biographer, Andrew Loney.
I mean, clearly, members of the family, including King Charles, knew about Andrew's activities. They were warned about his abuse of his royal position to make money for himself. I mean, that was appearing in the papers 15 years ago, and they chose to do nothing about it.
Since Andrew's arrest, Loney has been inundated with even more claims about who knew what about the Playboy Prince.
It's been crazy since Thursday. I mean, I think at one point I had 1,200 emails I still hadn't read, and I've been working from 6 in the morning till 2 in the morning. I think what's gratifying is to see other people standing up and saying, you know, the monarchy needs to modernise and reform. So I'm no longer, I think, a lone voice, and others feel as strongly as I do that for the monarchy to survive, it has to adapt.
Before too long, the weight of the royal family will fall on William's shoulders. But with a potential prosecution to come and the airing of all the dirty laundry that will entail, can he restore the family reputation? From The Guardian, I'm Helen Pitt. Today in Focus, the fallout from the royal arrest. Andrew Loney, you've written a biography of Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor called Entitled, The Rise and Fall of the House of York, which involved, I think, you asking 3,000 people, not all of whom replied, about the prince. So I think it's fair to say that you are a scholar of him and his lifetime of scandals. This episode is going to go out a week after Andrew was arrested on suspicion of misconduct in a public office. Did you ever think it was going to come to this?
No, of course not. I just sought to write a biography, the best I could do. I spent 4 years researching it. I thought it would draw attention to his sexual and financial misdemeanors, but I didn't expect any impact. And to be honest, the book came out in August, and we didn't have people knocking on his door and taking him in for questioning. The tipping point has been the new Epstein revelations in the last few weeks, which, of course, have confirmed all the things that I said and people didn't believe 6 months ago. So that's very gratifying that my sources proved to be accurate. And it is exciting that a book can have some sort of impact.
Yeah. And the arrest, of course, is related to Andrew's position as a UK trade envoy, a role that he held from 2001 until 2011. And I find it quite curious, actually, that he was given a job like
that at a time when he was already considered a bit of a liability, wasn't he? Like, all throughout my childhood in the 90s, he was the playboy prince. He was Randy Andy.
The Queen called her second son Andrew Albert Christian Edward, but his nicknames give a better clue to his personality. Randy Andy is the best known. The prince has a practiced eye for the ladies, and his romantic adventures have been well publicised.
Is it very difficult for you to meet a girl and to, I mean, ask for a telephone, for example, and know that that person perhaps is terrified of all the press attention that you get?
Yes, I think to a certain extent they probably are. But if you remember, I didn't get your telephone number.
Can you just help us understand why he was given this job? And was it a real role or just sort of a pretend one to keep him out of trouble in some way?
Well, it was a real role. It's a role the Duke of Kent had had. It's a role that the future Edward VIII had had, in some ways using the soft power of the monarchy to reach places that politicians couldn't reach. I mean, the Liberals have now called for a debate to get all the papers to show how that appointment was made, because, as you say, people had some idea of what he was like. But it was pushed through by the Queen, and basically very hard to turn down anything the Queen wanted. She wanted a son who basically had run out of road in the Navy to have a big job, and they thought that this would be a big job.
Britain's Duke of York, Prince Andrew, is travelling to Egypt this weekend to co-chair the World Economic Forum on the Middle East. Like Davos earlier in the year, all the movers and shakers are due to be there, from President Bush and Egyptian President Mubarak to Tony Blair. For the last 7 years, he's been around the world travelling, promoting British business. 25 countries in 1 year last year, I think.
It was against the wishes of King Charles, pushed through by Peter Mandelson and Tony Blair, both of whom, of course, figure in the Epstein papers. But I think the problem was there was no proper supervision, and he was kind of left to do what he wanted, and he kind of took advantage of the situation to exactly do as he wanted, chase women, play golf and make money.
And so you say that the Prince of Wales, as was the King as he is now, was concerned at the time and raised his concerns. What was he worried about?
I think he knew his brother. He knew his brother could be very boorish. He could put people's backs up. He was socially gauche. He thought he knew it all. And he was absolutely right. And the whole thing was kind of contained. In the end, the ambassadors didn't request Andrew because he was counterproductive. Andrew kind of imposed himself with Fergie on his coattails, trying to pick up business cards wherever she could. And he was kind of left to do his own thing. He would go to places like Thailand on the taxpayer's tab and then have what he called private time. So we'd pay for a week, basically, in effect, in some resort in Thailand. And he just took advantage of the system, and he was sticking, as we know, all sorts of expenses on this, including his massages, insisting on private jets when commercial flights would do.
Kevin, we've heard from two former civil servants, one of whom said that he was so annoyed at Andrew's attempt to claim for massage services that he tried to block that expenses payment, but he was overruled by a more senior member of staff. Another former Whitehall official says that he was shocked at the extent what was described as Andrew's lavish lifestyle while he was...
And it was all sort of rubber stamped and sent through. So it's not entirely Andrew's fault. He worked the system, but the system allowed him to behave like this.
And there's one anecdote in your book where apparently Andrew's staff, while he was abroad, was often requesting that attractive women be invited to events, to which one consul replied, "I'm a diplomat, not a pimp." So it was fairly blatant, was it, his behaviour when he was abroad?
Yes, it was, absolutely. And there are, you know, numerous stories of him veering off from shaking hands with VIPs to talk to a pretty girl. Sometimes he just disappeared with someone he'd picked up. He was always going to nightclubs with girls being provided in the VIP room. The ambassador sometimes lost sight of him. He would stay in hotels rather than in the ambassador's residence, particularly ones with nice nightclubs that he could go to. So, yeah, he used this as just an opportunity to pick up women. And, of course, there are plenty of women who are quite happy to be picked up by the son of the Queen.
Indeed. And was there a specific trip that Andrew went on where we know now that it didn't go to plan behind the scenes and you had potentially diplomats tearing their hair out about his behaviour?
Oh, countless trips. I mean, there was a whole file at the Foreign Office of complaints from ambassadors, though they learnt that if they did complain, it might jeopardise their career. But, you know, people eventually gave up complaining. I mean, I've got stories in the book of, you know, for example, a diplomatic incident with the Sultan of Oman because Andrew was trying to cash money off him. People in the Gulf complained that he was trying to sell his house Sunning Hill to them. So, yeah, numerous complaints and nothing was done. I mean, some of these complaints were appearing in the papers from ambassadors. So, yeah, no one could be in any doubt that this guy was a liability to Britain.
And as there is now an ongoing police investigation into whether Andrew committed misconduct in a public office while doing that job, we do need to be a little bit careful about how we talk about all of this. And we should, of course, stress that Andrew has consistently denied any wrongdoing. But we know, of course, that his arrest was prompted by the release of the Epstein files. Can you just remind us, what were the key allegations contained in the files relating to how Andrew behaved when he was trade envoy that raised questions of whether or not he broke the law?
Well, there were a series of stories, many of them which were actually in my book and didn't seem to make much impact in August. He was looking for investment opportunities in Helmand Province just after the war there, when troops were still, I think, serving there. I mean, just basically everything that came across his desk, almost immediately it was sent off to someone like Epstein. And then there was almost a quid pro quo. He would then ask Epstein for some money for Fergie's bills. So this was, in effect, selling information. There's also claims now, which I believe, that he was betraying military and diplomatic secrets. So there's actually a more serious charge that could be levelled against him of treason.
Goodness. And as you say, there were concerns raised about Andrew's appointment as trade envoy at the time. And we may soon learn more about that appointment after MPs voted this week to release paperwork relating to how he actually got that job.
Can there be many people more symbolic of the rot that eats away at the British establishment than the former Duke of York and Special Trade Envoy?
How damaging do you think that could be, both for Andrew and the rest of the royal family, as well as for the Labour government at the time?
I mean, I've been trying for 5 years to get access to the files on his time as a trade envoy, and they've used every exemption possible to stop me having them. I think the shredders are working 24 hours at the moment in Whitehall. I don't think we're going to get any paperwork that will have a smoking gun on anything. So good news for the government, good news for the royal family. But the royal family are clearly being drawn into this. I mean, clearly members of the family, including King Charles, knew about Andrew's activities. They were warned about his abuse of his royal position to make money for himself. I mean, that was appearing in the papers 15 years ago, and they chose to do nothing about it. And so I think they have to take some responsibility here. They can't say, sorry, this is all news to us and we'll deal with it, because they knew about it and didn't deal with it.
Yes, and yet the King put out a statement last week saying, I have learned with the deepest concern the news about Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. So he doesn't even say about my brother, very much distancing himself from his brother. Have they always had a bad relationship, these two, or has it just worsened over the decades?
Well, the relationship, I think, was not too bad to start with. I mean, Charles is 12 years older. He treated him very much as a younger brother. I mean, he's a very kind man. And he would write children's stories and read them out to Andrew, but they're very different temperaments. I mean, Charles is intellectually curious, he's sensitive, thoughtful, modest, self-deprecating, whereas Andrew is bumptious, pompous, arrogant, stupid, has no hinterland. So there's not much in common between them. And of course, Andrew's created huge reputational damage for the monarchy. He's been a pain at home. So there's no love lost there. I mean, I think they'd be secretly pretty pleased if he went to prison. It would kind of solve their problems.
And King Charles said in his statement, the law must take its course. Earlier this year, of course, he stripped Andrew of his titles. Do you think that he went far enough, quickly enough, given what you know about all of the warnings that must have reached Charles's desk over the years?
No, it was always too little too late, just enough that hopefully to satisfy public opinion. But public opinion was way ahead of actually where the palace was. So there were always, you know, small concessions in the hope that would make the problem go away. And all it did was allow the crisis to get bigger and bigger. If they'd nipped it in the bud much earlier, we wouldn't be where we are today, which is, you know, where people are calling for Charles to abdicate.
And could you just give us a sense of the opportunities over the years that Charles and indeed his mother would have had to, as you say, nip this behaviour in the bud and stop him from carrying on like this?
Well, in 2010, Sarah Ferguson was filmed by the News of the World selling access to Andrew for £500,000.
I mean, did you take the money? At one stage you had $40,000 cash sitting in front of you. Did you take
it? Absolutely, yes. And it was given to me and I got it in the car and then returned it straight away.
Once the scandal broke?
As soon as I knew it was a scandal, not once it broke.
Now, clearly the two of them were working together. This wasn't an isolated incident. That would have been one opportunity to really come down on them.
And why do you think the Queen in particular turned a blind eye?
Well, exactly like Margaret Thatcher did to Mark Thatcher. Love is blind when you're a mother. And she didn't want to hear when stories were brought about him. She just dug her head in the sand. He was her favourite and she wanted only the best for him. And I think there was a sense, even with her, of entitlement, that basically because they knew they wouldn't be caught, there was no scrutiny, they could do what they wanted. And that kind of went to their head.
The Queen obviously is not with us anymore. Charles is on the throne. As we said, he's stripped Andrew of his titles. Is there any further action that he, as king, could take to punish his brother?
Well, I don't think it's a matter of punishing his brother. I think it's a matter of being honest about what he knew, when he knew it, and what he did. Because I think the question now is about the king's accountability for this. The law will take its course with Andrew. I think as long as Charles cooperates fully, makes any internal reports, for example, of the complaints that were brought available, makes sure that all the people who accompanied Andrew on these trips speaks to the police. They don't have NDAs hovering over them. I mean, I've seen letters from December telling police that they have obligations of confidentiality and must keep quiet. So if the Crown is prepared to cooperate with the state, then that's fine. But I think there's an awful lot of window dressing going on, an awful lot of saying things in public, but actually very different things going on behind the scenes.
Right. And what do you make of the move led by some Labour backbenchers to effectively remove Andrew's right to ever reach the throne, unlikely as that is, given that he's eighth in the line of succession? Do you think that that's something realistic that could ever happen?
No, I think that's complete gesture politics. He's never going to come to the throne. He's never going to be a councillor of state. This is using up parliamentary time, which I think could be better spent. I know the royal family wouldn't want any debates about Prince Andrew. I mean, they've already got to the problems of the Crown Estates being looked at by the Public Accounts Committee. There, I think, there's a debate going on which will look at some issues with Andrew. And we finally got round this Erskine May directive that, you know, you can't ask any questions about the royal family. I think we are moving to a position where there could be some scrutiny. So, no, I mean, it's a ridiculous thing. And it's just people jumping on a bandwagon thinking it's a good thing to do. Much more important to have a parliamentary inquiry into Andrew's time as a trade envoy and get all those people who may well, I would suggest, have abetted him or certainly would know what he was up to in places like Azerbaijan and Kazakhstan. You know, people who are meant to be supervising him at the UKTI, etc. Those are the people who should be talking so that we can make sure this doesn't happen again.
And how do you think this is all being viewed by Prince William? We know, of course, that his father is battling cancer. He's well into his 70s, so it's only a matter of time before Prince William will ascend to the throne himself. He was at the BAFTAs earlier this week saying he just wasn't in a calm enough state of mind to watch a particularly harrowing film, Hamlet.
But did you watch Hamlet as well?
You need to be in a quiet state. You'll be in a calm state of
acknowledgement. Do you think he's watching all of this play out very nervously?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think William has seen the reputational damage that Andrew is bringing.
Sir, to what extent do you think the royal family has done enough around the Andrew and Epstein issue? Sir, to what extent do you think the royal family has done enough around the Andrew and Epstein issue?
He's wanted to deal with them much more ruthlessly and earlier than Charles, who's kind of dithered over this. And he's going to have to pick up the pieces when he comes to the throne. And he's keen that Charles, in some ways, cleans out the stables before he gets there, because there'll be no throne for him to inherit. I mean, that may actually not upset William. He may be very happy to have the life of a country gentleman and not have all these pressures. But he's certainly worried about what his birthright's going to be, given the way the royal family have dealt this. This is, as I say, a crisis they've brought on themselves because they've handled it so badly.
Coming up, can William and Kate turn the tide of public opinion? What do you think the public is making of all of this? It's been striking, I thought, reading the coverage that even the Daily Mail, which arguably was the most loyal to the royal family, seems to be turning against them and sort of expressing disgust in what Andrew in particular has been doing.
Yes, I think it's very interesting that the debate has got much wider into royal accountability and privilege. And I mean, take papers like The Times, The Telegraph, and as you say, The Mail, which you would think were pretty sympathetic, are now very open saying, you know, we need to look at this again. But I've been calling for greater accountability for at least a decade now, very much a lone voice and slightly sort of vilified for it. But I think, you know, so many people are now saying these things, including distinguished royal commentators like David Dimbleby.
I mean, obviously, there's a key question. Why, on Peter Mandelson's recommendation, was he made trade envoy? But then who paid the £12 million to Virginia Dufresne to shut her up? Who was that? Was that our money or was that the Queen's private money? I mean, these are big issues. Where does their money come from? We're never really told.
This is their sort of crossroads moment. They can redefine themselves, the 21st century, by making themselves less secretive, or they can basically bring on their own demise by being so intransigent and just being so unaware of actually what public opinion is.
And what is public opinion? What do we know about how Britons are feeling about the monarchy now compared with in decades past?
The support for the monarchy is falling. I mean, clearly Andrew is deeply unpopular. William and Catherine seem to still be popular. But I think I saw a poll on Friday saying that 79% of those under 30 have no interest in the monarchy. So it's kind of withering away. It's losing any relevance to the new generation. And as a monarchist, I think the monarchy serves a very useful purpose. I want it to stay, but I want it to stay with something that we can respect.
And you say that, for you, the monarchy does serve a useful purpose. What is that purpose now? And what would it look like with William and Kate, Catherine, as I should call her, at the top of the tree?
Well, I think there's always a role for the royal family to exercise soft power in support of the government. We saw this with Trump recently.
It's a singular privilege to be the first American president welcomed here. This is truly one of the highest honors of my life. Such respect for you and such respect for your country.
We see it in the way the royals clearly are very popular in the Middle East. You know, they are a focus for national grief, for example, or national success. You know, they hold the nation together and they personify the nation. And what we want is this family devoted to public duties who do good works, who highlight issues. But it does depend on respect and trust. And that has been lost through the activities of Sarah Ferguson and Andrew. And the fact the royal family turned a blind eye to this now for 40 years.
And how optimistic are you that William and Kate can turn the tide, especially among younger people who, as you say, the majority of whom are just not interested in the royal family? And in an age of social media where everything is scrutinised, authenticity, emotional honesty is the order of the day. And when they're competing with influencer culture, people like the Kardashians, their sort of celebrity star power is arguably not what it once was.
Things have changed. I think William and Catherine realise that. They're doing much more direct engagement through social media themselves, rather than relying on the frizzop of the Royal Rota. But, you know, people do expect a bit more accountability from people in public life. And I think they need to accept that. We know they need to be less opaque about their finances. There needs to be a proper records management system about their archives. The way that they communicate with the press needs to be, I think, more open rather than secret briefings and quid pro quo arrangements. They just need to operate like any business does, as openly and honestly as possible.
And of course, the monarchy has proved itself to be a remarkably resilient institution over the centuries. They've weathered all kinds of storms, beheadings, abdications, Diana's death, Megxit, when Harry and Meghan sort of stomped off in a mood to California. How serious do you think this is for them? And is it overstating it to suggest it could be the beginning of the end of the monarchy as we know it?
No, I don't think that's out of the question. I think this could be the beginning of the end of the monarchy, depending on how they play it. It could be the making of the monarchy or making of the new modern monarchy. But at the moment, they don't seem to have woken up and smelt the coffee yet. And they're sort of stumbling. They've lost the narrative. They're stumbling into, I'm afraid, their demise. And they need to really, I think, make some announcements about how they're going to reform the institution and become much more open. I mean, they need to be paying tax. They need to be seen to be paying tax. We need to know what it is. They need to have their royal wills unsealed. They need to be removed from the exemptions in the Freedom of Information Act. They need to accept parliamentary scrutiny. They need to have a royal register of their business activities. And most importantly, they need to start acting properly rather than using their position and privilege for their own personal gain.
Well, thank you very much for talking to us today.
Not at all. Pleasure. Thanks a lot.
That was Andrew Loney. His book, entitled The Rise and Fall of the House of York, is available now. My colleague Zoe Williams did a great interview with Andrew, the author, not the former prince, which you can find at theguardian.com, along with all of our coverage of this unfolding scandal. And that is all for today. This episode was produced by Natalie Katena and Tom Glasser and presented by me, Helen Pidd. Sound design was by Brian McNamara, and the executive producer was Maz Ebtahash.